Blog Talk Radio.
Everybody's got the fever. This is something we all know. Fever isn't such a new thing. Fever started long ago. Now,
good evening and welcome to Lenny Godfrey's Straight No Chaser. I really want to get to the chase, and there's a phrase. Melvin and I were talking about phrases. There you go. I really want to get to the chase of the matter and do some housekeeping, and so I can have conversations with my good friend. We are doing the part two of the two-year anniversary of Lenny Godfrey Straight No Chasers. So really proud to be able to be celebrating doing this for 2 years, and in 3 weeks we will be celebrating the 100th episode on the second part of the Dr. Edith Rock Workshop for Seniors. But I'll talk about that in a little while. Let me just now make sure that everyone knows where they are, and if you want to call in, that you have the proper information. First of all, you are on blogtalkradio.com. Specifically, you are on / S as in Sam, F as in Fred, T as in Tom, H as in Harry, and the number 2. I say that because that gets you directly to this program. And if you do put that in your computer or phone or iPad, laptop, you will then come to the website. You'll be able to view all of the almost 100 episodes that we have done in the last 2 years. They are archived here. And I am very, very proud to say that we've had such wonderful, wonderful guests that have entered into the doors of Lenny Godfrey Straight No Chaser, and I am proud of that. Now, the other thing is to tell you, those of you who called in, and I see the board is there, my California friends are here, my Texas friends are here, thank you very much. The number that they called in to is 516-453-6063. Some people call in to listen. Some people go on their computers and just listen directly on Blog Talk Radio and click to the episodes. So that's another way of doing it. Also, there is a video component to this program. Afterwards, Melba and I will be on a webinar, and the link is on Facebook if you want to join us. It is there right now. And you will be able to hear us continue the conversation from this hour conversation on there for about 10 or 15 minutes. And that is archived on YouTube and on Facebook. And on Facebook, you can get the connection for this from blogtalkradio.com on either the Lenny Godfrey personal page, Lenny Godfrey professional page, or Godly Entertainment. A lot of information, but I wanted to get it all in because people always ask me, well, where can I, get it? If I happen to miss the episode. So there are a lot of choices for you to do it. I do want to talk about what's coming on next week, because once Melvin and I start talking, I know that we're not going to get a chance to do it at the end. So next week, I have the first part of, stop laughing, Melvin, of a wonderful two-part series featuring the senior writers of the Dr. Edith Rock Workshop, which by the Center of Black Literature at the Medgar Evers College. And I have 3 writers who are coming in. I'm so very, very happy to welcome them. William Craig is there. Ms. Spence is there. And Sylvia Jones Ciccone is there. So we will be talking about them, about their lives, the first episode, and why they got into writing, and how they all were introduced into this workshop, and how they gathered their stories. And then the second week, which is the 100th anniversary, we will be asking them to read excerpts of their stories and explain to us how they came to be writing those stories. So that's going to be really wonderful, and I hope they're listening tonight. I invited them to come in and listen. And now it is time for me to introduce my guest of the evening, Miss Melva Tolliver, who I've known now, I don't know, it's not quite a decade since I moved into this area, who has been in the broadcasting business for at least 3 decades. I think she said that last week, but and her experience. But I think what would be interesting before she starts quizzing me, because she's going to do that, and before we start talking about all the things that she was talking about off air, which are these phrases, that you all find out what her initial occupation was before she started doing the broadcasting. So, with no further ado, well, we all know she's an accomplished journalist, writer, a wonderful broadcaster, a very curious person, articulate as the devil, and there's another phrase, I am so proud to say that she is my friend. And welcome, 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 Miss Melva Tolliver. Say hello.
Hi, Lenny.
Hello, Melva. You know, it's so wonderful to be able to sit on this program and talk to people that I'm friendly with and have a relationship with, and really be able to expose some of the things, and I don't say expose in a bad way, but inform the audience about things that they just didn't know about you. Why don't you briefly just, tell us how you got to come to New York City and whose decision and what vocation you came to New York City doing all those times, all those years before, in the Dunbar, you stayed at the Dunbar, another history, but.
Yes, the Paul Lawrence Dunbar Apartments on 149th 150th Street. Well, I grew up in Akron, Ohio, born in Rome, Georgia. My mother's oldest sister, Lyon Clarice, was a nurse. My mother thought it would be good for me to be a nurse. Not because I showed any talent in that direction, but as she said, if you become a nurse, you'll always have a job. There'll always be sick people, honey. You'll thank me one of these days. So that's how I had been to New York before on summer vacations with my sister Connie and my cousins Janice, Diane, and another cousin, Michael. We came to New York for like a week every summer out when school closed and stayed with my Aunt Clary, who when we came to stay with her, she covered up all the furniture with sheets so that we wouldn't scratch up the stuff or try to play the piano or do anything like that. Her big deal was to take us the same week was always the same thing. Statue of Liberty, Radio City Music Hall, Roxy Theater, Horn and Hard Art. We did the same thing. And then before we packed up and went back home, she took us shopping down at, I'm trying to think of this big store on 34th Street and 5th Avenue. Anyway, to buy something to take home to our mothers.
Was it
B. Altman?
Was it
right? B. Altman.
Yeah.
B. Altman.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But my first career, my first job, which was a job I got working behind the scenes at Lord & Taylor Department Store. And girl, I thought I was hot stuff. This was, my mother took me down to the Greyhound bus station and shipped me off like 2 days after I turned in my cap and gown from graduating from high school and got on the bus headed for New York, a one-way ticket with my suitcase and my Singer sewing machine, portable, that my mother had bought for me. So, but when I got to New York, my Aunt Clarice had a good friend who worked at Lord & Taylor, And in those days, you never saw any black people working on the floors of any of these ritzy department stores. They all worked behind the scenes or whatever. But anyway, Miss Wiggins, and Miss Wiggins was instrumental in getting me a job, which it seemed that all I did was like get these tags or tickets for children's clothes or something and sort them out for the different Lordan department stores in other parts of the country. Anyway, that's what I did. But and I was getting a paycheck. That was a big thing. And every morning I got up and got myself together and had breakfast and got on the bus headed downtown and dressed up like, you know, like a young career woman. And I was, so this was in June. School was opening in September. I had been accepted in nursing school at Bellevue in September. On September 17th was the first day of class, or when we had to be there. And I was just thinking, oh, after my first and second paychecks from Lord Taylor, I was saying, oh, my goodness, I hope that these people at Bellevue don't call me. I hope they think they made a mistake and I can keep working at Lord Taylor. I probably was making like $25 a week or whatever it was, but that was real money, you know. So anyway, the summer ended, and unfortunately, I had to go back. I had to go to school at Bellevue and spend 3 years there, and which had its ups and downs. I had never been even a candy striper before. going into Bellevue, but which is really probably still is considered the boot camp of nurses education, nurses training, because that was one tough place. But in any case, my real first job was working at Lord & Taylor. But then I finished at Bellevue, passed the state boards, and I worked for 2 years as an operating room nurse at Bellevue. Mainly because I realized I was no good as a bedside nurse. I just didn't have the right balance of compassion and sternness that's needed. And if somebody had to take some bad medicine or something, or I had to give them a treatment they didn't want, they'd say, oh, Miss Tolliver, please don't. And I'd say, okay, I won't. So I said, you know, you don't need to be at anybody's bedside. So I found the OR very interesting, and actually, you do not get emotionally attached to patients in the OR, because by the time they reach the OR, they've had a pre-anesthetic and they're groggy, the people who are undergoing surgery, and then they're wheeled into the OR and they're draped and anesthetized, and you don't really see the person anymore. You just see their guts or the inside of them. I shouldn't have put it that way. But anyway, you're not really emotionally attached to them, which may sound pretty cold, but it was a way to be a nurse but be distanced from the real part of you.
The medical profession, you know, people are human, and so even though it's a technical profession, and you say, you know, I'm going to go by the book, which is another phrase, okay?
Yes, go by the book.
Yes,
good.
Yeah, go by the book.
Okay.
But you do, you know, you do sit there and ask, you find out things about people, why they have the condition that they have, or the fact that no one knows why they have that condition, and the query about
right.
that, and all get involved in there in some point of their lives. Whereas when someone, as you said, they're asleep, they're, you know, they're rolled in, you come in, they're, you know, that they're the client of that procedure, you perform the procedure and it's done. You know, you don't have any personal attachment. So, and I think that is one of the things about being in the medical profession that's very difficult, is that after a while it wears on you. If you have those personal attachments wear on you, want the best for the client, and all the time, sometimes that doesn't happen. And you're human, mm-hmm. And you deal with that. So, so now you've spent how many years as an operating nurse in the OR?
About 2 years at Bellevue. I also worked at this other hospital that I worked at, Flower Fifth Avenue. It no longer exists, but I did work there, and I worked nights there as an OR nurse. And that's when I also had a side career at the New York World's Fair.
Good gosh.
Oh,
go ahead.
I had met somebody, and I was going to get married, and I got this job at working during the day at the World's Fair on the Hollywood Pavilion. People who are listening to this program, I mean, maybe there are people old enough to remember the 1964 World's Fair, the World's Fairground out in Queens. Yeah. I got a job there, and it was really ridiculous on the part of the fair that I worked on. The Hollywood Pavilion had these sets, like a set from a movie, this movie or that one, westerns and so on. The one I worked on was, and we were told, I don't know if it was really true, this was actually the set that Richard Burton and Elizabeth Taylor, one of the sets that they had worked on when making the movie Cleopatra. So there was very little that you had to do, those of us who were working at the World's Fair on this infamous set. We just came out dressed in these short togas, nothing revealing, but just that they were short. And a woman, a girl who was being Cleopatra, she came out first, and we came out behind her waving these fans. And she took a seat on a throne, and we just sat. She sat there, and we stood there while people took our pictures. Of course, that did not make for very much excitement on this particular set. There were other sets that came from westerns and God knows what else. Maybe there were about 10 of them all together. But anyway, the Hollywood, the Cleopatra set is the one I was on. But after a couple of weeks of this boring setup, the person in charge there decided that they would make it more, in fact, the whole Hollywood Pavilion, they were going to make more active. Our set, they were going to have dancers. So we were in, those of us, these young girls, maybe there were about six or seven of us, plus the girl who was Cleopatra, we were invited to audition to dance on this set. And we would make more money, too, on top of it. So they held the audition at a studio in Manhattan. And I showed up for the audition. Why not? And the choreographer didn't give us much in the way of steps. It was really kind of freelance to see how you can move. They played some music, and we did whatever as a group. And lo and behold, I found out I was accepted as one of the dancers. And I thought, wow, this is great. Work in the OR at Flower Fifth Avenue at night, come out to the World's Fair, be on the Hollywood set and dance and make more money and save up for my wedding. Well, The choreographer, after the audition, he held the first rehearsal. And the people who showed up, some of them were real dancers, people who had danced on Broadway. Anyway, after the first routine he gave us, he called me over to the side, and he said, "Are you sure you're in the right place?" I said, "Yes." Excuse me. "I'm in the right place. I'm on the Cleopatra set." And so anyway, he didn't say any more. And then when I went back to the Cleopatra set, the stage manager came over and he says, "Melba, the choreographer says you are not right for this dance routine, and you have a choice. You can go back to just waving the fan, or you can insist on remaining as a dancer, but you will be fired in 2 weeks. And he said, excuse me, he said, as long as you're, if you go back to being the fan waiver, you'll be here as long as I'm here. I can guarantee you that. But if you insist on staying with the dance, you're going to be finished in 2 weeks. So I went home that night and I thought about it. I was making more money as a dancer than a fan waiver. So I went back the next day and I said, well, you know what? I've decided I will continue as a dancer. And the man, he just didn't believe it. But the thing that this just teaches you, he was fired before I was fired. He and his wife, both of them. And I said, see that? He's guaranteeing me I'll be here as long as he's here. He's gone. I still have a couple of more days. So that was the beginning and the end of my dance career. Excuse me for all this coughing, but that was a real learning experience, but also experience of, you can see, when you've got a hard head or you're either very naive, you'll do just about anything that doesn't make sense in retrospect.
Well, you know, I think you go, like you said, you know, why not? You know, I mean, why not? Why not? The worst thing that can happen is that you don't continue. So why not try? I think it's fascinating, all of these adventures that you got. Now, how did, all right, so now I've got all of these.
Now, Lenny, that's enough about Melba's.
How did you get to the broadcasting? I'm trying to get you to the broadcasting. You never got to the broadcasting part.
Well, the broadcasting is very short. I stayed in nursing, working in the operating room, and then at a point where I was, I had left the operating room and was working in working what's called per diem by the day. I wasn't on staff anywhere, and I was working this one period in the emergency room at Bellevue. I was there one evening when two young people, a sister and a brother in their early 20s, came in. They had been in an auto accident, a wreck. Their brother who was driving was not injured, but these two people had suffered awful internal injuries, and they died within minutes of each other. And that was the end for me. I could not get these people out of my mind. I went home at night, and I just cried and thought about the brother who survived, what he must feel like, and the parents. It was just too much. I said, I just cannot stay in this field. And then I just started, and by then I was married, but I just started looking around saying, I've got to find something that I can do, but it can't be working in a hospital. I can't be a nurse. Anyway, at one point I read in the New York Times that ABC News was hiring secretaries. Followed up the ad, went down to ABC News headquarters, 1336th Avenue, and again, I had no experience as a secretary, but I had learned to type when I was in high school, and I went and joined a group of other people who were taking the secretarial tests or whatever, and they took this brief bio information, and then they led us into a room where and asked us to have a seat. And I thought that this room where they had these earphones, I said, oh, they're checking our hearing. That's interesting. Well, this was dictation, which shorthand, I didn't know the first thing about shorthand. So I had to ask to be excused from that and go back into the waiting room. And while I'm sitting there, I'm saying, Melba, please. Forget about it. These people are not going to hire you to be a secretary. This is about the same as being hired as a dancer, you know. Anyway, to my surprise, the woman in charge came out and said, Miss Tolliver, yes, so-and-so, oh, your test came out very well. And I said, she must have me mixed up with somebody else. But anyway, I said, Miss, you know, I'm out here because I don't take shorthand. She says, well, we have somebody who you would be good for. His secretary doesn't need to know shorthand. You can type. So I want you to go over to 7 West 66th Street and meet this gentleman who's the head of this department at ABC News, a man whose name was Don Coe, bless his heart. And he and I met, talked, and he thought I would work out fine. And I thought, well, this will be a great way to get my foot in the door, because what I really had in mind is I can learn what it takes to be a researcher. Since, you know, I'm curious, George, I always want to have some questions.
Yes.
About things like reading, like meeting people, talking. I thought research would be perfect, even though I didn't know anybody who was a researcher. So I gave myself 6 months to be the secretary to Don Coe. During that time, I was so busy trying to handle an electric typewriter that I never got around to meeting any researchers. I never even got away from that desk. When there was a strike of on-the-air people after the American Federation of Television and Radio Artists, and all the on-air people, and there was a news program on ABC at the time, 5 minutes to 2:55, I think it was. It was a five-minute network that is national news program. It went on across the whole country, and it was called News with the Woman's Touch, anchored by Marlene Sanders. Marlene was one of the people who walked out, and the ABC executives, in their foresight and planning for a strike that nobody thought was going to happen, they assigned a man to do News with the Woman's Touch. And the day of the strike, when the strike happened and I came to work and went into the building, my boss was at a meeting where they found out that the sponsors did not want a man anchoring their News with the Woman's Touch program. And these executives hadn't counted on that, and they were scurrying around trying to find somebody to sit in for Marlene Sanders. And then my name was brought up by my boss. And when he came back from this meeting, called me into his office, closed the door and said, do you think you could substitute for Marlene just for today until we can find somebody who could actually do this? And I thought, yeah, I guess I could. So that was it. I went on the air. Anchor this five-minute network news show, and that was, as the saying goes, the rest is history. But again, people, anybody hearing this story, and many people have heard this story, if anybody's listening who is old enough to remember this time, this was the 1960s, 1967, the Kerner Commission report. The result of Lyndon Johnson's attempt to have a commission looking into the riots, that the first one that happened in Watson, 65, and then the ones that happened in Newark and just all across the country. And that resulted in the Kerner Commission report. And that commission, one of its most damning, indictments, was against the news media for its failure to communicate, especially to communicate about Negroes who were part of the news media audience but not getting real substantial coverage. So there I was. There was the Kerner Commission report, and there were the ramifications of it, and I was in the right place at the right time. And they decided, I should stay on the air because, what the heck, they didn't have anybody else. Plus, there was quite a bit of reporting about the man who sat in for Walter Cronkite, the person who took over for Peter Jennings, for Huntley Brinkley. And the publicity just was fine for as far as I was concerned. The man who wrote about me said, well, she didn't have that deer in the headlights look and seemed comfortable or whatever he said. The only thing is he called me Mabel, which,
oh,
I, you know, didn't like that. But
no,
my
no,
hometown newspaper covered it, the Associated Press and all that. So the publicity was okay.
Yeah, that came out of...
Let me drink some water.
Well, now,
but
all right, I'm going to give you an opportunity to get a drink of water, but see,
I have some water right there. But how that wound up is I stayed on the air, and then ABC decided to start an in-house training program. And I went from being a secretary to be the guinea pig for that training program. And then that resulted in my... being hired as a vacation relief reporter for Channel 7, the flagship station for the ABC news network, which was just down the street. People who remember those times will remember Gil Noble, who was already working at Channel 7.
Yes, and, absolutely.
Mm-hmm. And I was hired as a vacation relief reporter. And then I was hired as a full-time reporter. And that's my story.
Well, I can guarantee you, not having been there, but I can just about guarantee that probably your point of view and your curiosity, how the things that you would ask people naturally, because I will say to the audience right now that even when we were on, before we got on the air, I was talking in a, I guess you call it a parable or phrases that are symbolic, and you immediately, you know, you said, yes, that's what I have a curiosity about. Where did these phrases come from? And how do we know what they meant? And then we were talking about hot as a pistol, or you strike while the iron is hot. I just want the audience to know that, seriously, we could be talking about any subject that can come up. And out of that subject, Melba will find some really significant thing to ask a question about. And what it was, I said, you know, well, I'm strong as healthy as a horse or something like that. And she said, well, who decided that horses were healthy? You see what I'm saying? That's what I'm saying. And then we went on to this, you know, to start talking about all these phrases, hot as a pistol. Like I said, you know, I want to go straight to the chase. And I didn't even realize that, again, that was one of those phrases that we use, not realizing the origin of it. And that it usually is based on something. Now, I don't know, you know, what straight to the chase meant. I know straight no chaser means, you know, no water in your drink, you know, when you're talking about liquor. But I find that that's what is one of the fascinating things about you. Now, we promised the audience last week that we would talk about mentors. Right, Melba?
Mm-hmm. Okay. I wanted you to talk about that because...
Yes, I know. And now that you've talked, you know, I'm very, very satisfied that I've given you the opportunity again to really tell people what your journey was, because it's such an interesting journey. I mean, I didn't know the part about the dancing part. I'm, you know, the retail to the nurse to the performer to the dancer to the answering the ad to the secretary on the way to the wet, fascinating journey. In there somewhere, you, I'm sure, had someone that inspired you. I'm going to take the lead on the people who were inspirational and supportive to me I believe, as a child and as a young adult, and ultimately still are supportive in my life. I think it all started, never mind my parents, because those two people, Fred and Maggie Gottfried, probably were instrumental in formulating my security as a human being. In other words, saying, and preparing me for and creating an atmosphere where I really thought that there was no ceiling. A lot of people talk about a glass ceiling. There was no ceiling. I mean, mm-hmm. I just thought you were what you pursued what you wanted to be. And given the right opportunity and the right preparation and all of those things, you would achieve it. Of course, eventually I found out that those things are necessary, but there are other elements that come into the equation that make it more challenging. And I was equipped by that time to deal with that. But as a child, I think it's very important, I believe, to feel that you can achieve anything, that there were no borders, that there were no, with all of the borders that were put on black children at that time. And there were many. I mean, you know, there were a lot of people who taught their children, you know, you have to do this because this will be the only thing that you can do. And, you know, and that's the safe thing. And one of the things that I wanted to be was a teacher. I didn't want to be a teacher because it was the safe thing. It was because I loved playing with my dolls and loved the blackboard and loved being able to have to play like I had eyes in the back of my head and I could make sure that when Jimmy was talking, I'd say, Jimmy, you stop talking, Jimmy. I can see you, you know. All of those wonderful moments.
Mm-hmm.
I loved that you would see on maybe on television everything about what teachers were. I thought it was a magnificent job. When other opportunities came, my mother was very opportunistic. They were very, very simple people from the South who really had very little training but decided that they would work and make money and make a good life. And so they found jobs, and then they created their own businesses. And I can tell you now that I don't remember my parents telling me, oh, I'm so tired, I don't see, I don't remember that. And they had regular jobs, they had their businesses on the weekend. And so I was raised with that work ethic. And then my mother discovered that I could sing, and she decided that she had heard that there was a wonderful voice teacher in Williams Institutional AME Church, which is where I was baptized as a child. It still existed right there in Harlem Avenue. And Dr. Chauncey Notis was in charge of the chorus. And she had me go there and sing for him. And he listened to the voice and said, yes, she has potential. He was the encouragement. He was the disciplinarian. He had a level of excellence that you wanted to hit every single time you hit the studio in Carnegie Hall. You were there on time. You were there prepared. And if you weren't, he would draw a jackass on your card. He wouldn't give you an F. You're a jackass. So I remember, and I still have my cards.
really?
He was incredible. He was one of the first tenors to do Othello in Europe. He had a wall full of what we would call the Negro performers that you would see in movies, but they would come to Dr. Northern for voice placement, for speech placement. And I would look on his wall, and I would see all these people that I would see on television when they were, you know, when they were parts for black people to be in. They were character actors. It was fabulous. And I, you know, until college, I didn't, and I started studying when I was like 7 or 8 years old. Until college, I didn't think of a career like those people had. I thought I was developing and that I would sing on the weekends and I would teach school, and that was it. That was all. It was he who decided that I had a range that needed to have attention, and He and my mother decided that this was something that I should pursue all the time. And instead of going once a week like your children go, I would go in a studio twice a week and listen to the sopranos that he had, Theodosia Young and Cynthia Burke were their names. They were absolutely brilliant. I listen to sopranos now that people go crazy about their control. They would do duets, Madame Butterfly. They did things, I don't know. I know as an adult now that were, it was absolutely incredible. But their musicality was fabulous because both of them were pianists. So they understood the music. They understood the mood of the, why the piece was written, and along with his tutelage. It was an incredible tutoring session for someone who was 10, 11, 12 years old. He would have me sit there and watch them until to the point my first aria was Vissidate. And I sang that from the time that I was 13 until I was 21, until I really got a chance to really sing. But that was the, and it's a hard, you know, it's a long range and strong voice. He then had the vision that said, okay, now I think you need to go to school, you need to study this, and I did. I went to one school, came back and studied with him, and then finished at Hunter College. I went to Hampton University, and that was a wonderful experience, but realized that I needed to have more focus with him. And my, and then my other mentor was Lloyd Richards, who I stumbled upon when I came back here at Hunter College, just looking for a Black theater history course, thinking, well, maybe I'll do something in history, where my teacher at Hampton University was Marjorie Moon, who used to run the Billie Holiday Theater, but that was before. And she said, you know, I think you could be in theater. And I went, what is theater? I mean, I've been singing, but theater is something different. And they are two different things. Oh, studying with both of these men, studying with Lloyd in the morning sometimes, then going to lunch and a break and going to Carnegie and taking class and then coming back to Hunter doing the evening classes and rehearsals. That was my college education and tutelage with these men, really telling me, you know, preparing me for a career before I graduated, warning, explaining to me what the pitfalls were, explaining the reality of what being a singer was. I never had the desire to be in opera. I was trained in opera, but I didn't have the desire. Listening to the stories of the limitations of people of color at that point in time, and how, and the women who I thought were some of the best singers I ever heard were relegated to the chorus in the Met. And I said, chorus? You know, but they were in the Met chorus. They were. And that's how I got started, those two men. And then, of course, along the way, there were other people in the business who I always say, these people were brave, because I'm not any type. I'm not a type. I'm not an ingenue type that has the ingenue voice. I had the ingenue look, and I have the voice of the character woman with the booming voice. So what does one do with somebody like that? You know. So I worked for people who were brave, who said, okay, we're going to try, and we're going to create something for you, because what is in existence now doesn't necessarily fit you. You know, you don't fit it like a glove. You're not in the category. So I thank all those brave people all along the way who gave me those opportunities, who made me not question. You know, sometimes you say to me, well, Lenny, what do you think about? Do you think about, you know, what it would be like to do this when you start thinking about a project? I don't. I thought, oh, that's interesting. Let me try that. That's it. That's it. It works. Great. It doesn't work. Great. You know, it's not for me. But I try to do all that I can within that project to make it as a successful journey as it possibly can to meet the challenge. And that came from the training, modern school training, where Mildred Johnson was the principal. Eleanor B. Sellers was a teacher who was determined to have your articulation be that of an articulate person. People would say, oh, you sound like a white girl. And she would say, when they say to me, say, you sound like an articulate person, because not all white people sound like that.
Mm-hmm.
And that, those kind of people who had that impression upon me, oh, yeah, I was a fast little girl in school, yeah. But, you know, I had fun. I was cute, and I liked to have little boyfriends, and you know, that stopped as a distraction very quickly, because once you study, you don't have time for all of that, you know. And became politically aware in high school, and then decided I really wanted to concentrate on the arts. So there you have it. Boom. There you have it.
Well, I've always been impressed with how the impact that Lloyd Richards, I had heard about Marjorie Moon, though I didn't really know as much about her, but I had heard about Lloyd Richards from other people, especially a woman named Janet McLaughlin. Somehow she was around in some of the same circles that she was, and I know she was a student of his too. But anyway, that's when I first heard of him. So I was always impressed by the influence that he had in your life, and his seeing the let me get this straight, but having something to do with your seeing your ability to be a director, not just person on stage, but the person who could who could actualize a writer's vision. That's what I mean to say.
Well, you know, he saw it very early. First of all, it was a practical choice, because at Hunter College at the time, there were no roles that were being featured and given to black women, you know, young black women. The young white women were given the leading roles, period. That was it. There was nothing in the agenda that was being focused on that. That came later, and I'm glad that it did. But when I was there, it was just the beginning when it was thought of. But what they were welcoming were the plays and productions that did feature people of color. And what Lloyd would say is, well, you don't have the opportunity to be a lead, but you know what that means. He would see that how I would direct myself in monologues in class, and he said, you can do that. He said, if you don't see it, create it. So you want a play, and one of the first plays that I did, I do want to get his name right now. Charles Fuller wrote a play called All's Fair. Charles Fuller wrote Soldier's Story. But
Soldier's Story of
Soldier's Play. Soldier's Play, and the screenplay, the Soldier's Story. And that was the first play that I directed. And I pulled black students, economics department, the history department, language department. I mean, because there were not a lot. I don't know. I might have been the only black actor who continued all the way through. I think Debbie Austin Williams was the other one, who stayed all the way through. But most of the time, they took a class or two of black history, and then they went on to something else. But I became a theater major. And so I knew the students, other students, and I corralled them on in. And we had wonderful productions because we were all students who wanted to see ourselves on stage. And he encouraged that from the very beginning. And they, therefore, and I remember one of my good friends and guests, Marie Thomas Foster, was said to me that I always spoke and always thought like a producer for her, you know. A lot of people say, you know, you always talk like a producer, not like someone whose main focus is the acting. I love the acting, but the main focus for me is all of that. It is that entity, you know. I don't see what I enjoy being the actor in the production, not having the responsibility of the whole thing, and coming and creating that, and then I'm ready to go and do something else along with that. Sometimes it's singing, sometimes it's directing, sometimes it's doing other things. But yeah, so you know, that's my story, and I'm sticking to it.
Well, it's interesting that your initial vision for yourself was to be a teacher, because that was
Absolutely.
What I thought seriously as you do when you're 15, 16 in that, but as a teacher. Mm-hmm. But for me, people who have been influential, in addition to my mother, who, as when we spoke before, I told you about coming to the understanding, the appreciation of how homeschooling, the way it's talked about now, was something that didn't have that title when I was coming along, but I was homeschooled at home by my first teacher, my mother. And I was well prepared for school by the time I went into first grade. I didn't go to kindergarten, but I had been well schooled at home. So I was very, very fortunate. And now, I really am a word person, though. I really love words and the origination, the origin of words and how we can't come to put certain combinations together. But this notion about homeschooling, it's that's not anything new, but it's, you know, we talk about it these days as if this is some sort of modern invention and something that's an alternative to public school. But homeschooling is what it is.
It's been
from the very beginning. But two teachers, and especially a teacher that I had in fifth grade, was very influential and I think about her more and more the older I get. Mrs. Lewis, who had a wooden leg, a white woman who looked like she was 100 at that time. She may have only been in her 40s, but I remember after she had us do some reading at Allen Elementary School in this one class, do some reading, and then she asked a question about the reading, and I was one of the people who raised it in my hand, and when she called on me and I said whatever I said, I don't remember the reading, I don't remember the question, I don't remember my response. What I do remember is Mrs. Lewis said, "Melba, you have a good mind. Pause when you use it." I was like, wow. That stayed with me because she was, what I realized so many years after, she was pointing out that was something I had control over, my mind, and it's something I could use. And it's not like saying, oh, you have nice hair or you have pretty legs or a nice smile, but you have a good mind. So I think about her and some of the other teachers and just think about how they don't know the extent and the breadth of their influence of so many people who have the good fortune to pass by them, and they're just there.
I think that's an important part. Teachers who are good for me were not good for everybody. You know, I mean, I think that who really are good for children who excel and who really are can catch on quickly. And then there are some special teachers who are for people who don't. And it should never be mixed. In my day, it was mixed. And some of the people who were slower were punished because they were slower. And that made me want to be a teacher more because I didn't want to ever do that to a student. I think that's one of the things that I resented by a lot of the teachers especially in private school, that, you know, they isolated you in groups. And if you were always in group one, see, it really didn't matter to you, but I'd look at the other people in the other groups and I thought, well, but they have potential in other ways. You know, why did you, I mean, group three, you are telling them, well, you know, it's hard for you to do this. But why, first of all, why a numerical? Why not group W, group Q, and group S? So there's no
right.
Thing, you know, why, you know, all of those things bothered me as a young girl, that students were relegated like that. And those, you know, the same five, six, seven of us were always in the same one, group one, you know. And it, some of people, it doesn't bother them. All they you know, to be very frank, all they cared about was themselves, so they didn't care, you know. But it bothered me. It bothered me. And I think it still is a concern. I'm always concerned when we have people all in one grouping and there's somebody who doesn't kind of get it right away. They are also aware that they're not getting it right away and they're holding everybody up. So you want to be able to create a safe atmosphere so they don't ever feel that complex, you know.
Exactly. So, and also the opportunity that it is for the other students to help. Because not all of them are going to feel like they have to be the best or better than everybody else. I mean, they would bring out maybe some, not even maybe, I believe that it would bring out the compassion of children who can get something quickly and want to share it with somebody who doesn't get along quickly. But here's this other saying, though, that addresses some of the point that you made, too, about who certain teachers and certain students and how they become a good match. The saying, I think it's a Buddhist saying, that when the pupil is ready, the teacher appears. Sometimes, even in our own life, somebody could teach us something, but we're not ready to hear it. We can't hear it at that time, whatever the reason why.
Yeah.
But a lot. There's a lot more than meets the eye. There's another one.
Now, there we go. Now we didn't get an opportunity to ask anybody about any questions tonight. Because we only have about a minute and a half left, so I'm going to ask everyone to join us on the webinar if they want to. We will continue this conversation because it is, you know, how you feel about the things that initially you wanted to be in and how they're being treated now, I think is an important thing to kind of discuss. And if you missed the webinar, it'll be posted up on Facebook initially. But I'd like to thank on this particular program my good friend, mentor of thought. I learned so much from you when I talked to you, Melba Tolliver. Thank you for taking our time for two consecutive weeks. And I look forward to the guests of next week who are coming on, Ms. Jones, Mr. Craig, Ms. Spence, Ms. Spencer, and Dr.
These are the Medgar Evers people, right?
Yes, from Medgar Evers. And you covered that
at
one point.
Yes,
you
and I pulled out the clip from my book of clips. I wrote about the Medgar Evers writing workshop. It was March of 1996. Can you believe it?
Wow.
And the headline of it is A Writing Renaissance. Black authors celebrate their growing visibility. It has a wonderful picture of Walter Mosley, another one of Terry McMillan, and another of B.B. Moore Campbell, the late B.B. Moore. It's the, that was Medgar Evers. And that was my first time attending that and getting a chance to write about it.
Yep, we're going to talk about it on the webinar. We're down to 30 seconds. So I'm going to say thank you to everyone and to invite them for next week. And I will see you on the radio, everyone. See you in a minute, Melba. See ya.
All right. Love you. Love your audience. Best to everybody. Bye-bye.
Everybody's got the fever. This is something we all know. Fever isn't such a new thing. Fever started long ago. Never